Episode 12 of the podcast is in the books and got to have a guest on that I've been threatening to have for several weeks now. Josh Feinblum is the head of security at Rapid7, and being the guy in charge of security at a security company certainly has a lot of different and unique challenges to it. So we talked a lot about what that means for him, how he builds a security team, what he looks for in the talent that he's doing, but also in, you know, the tools that he uses and his thoughts of how other companies can kind of get that type of validity and exposure for the security programs, even for companies that are not in the security space. So please enjoy episode 12 with Josh Feinblum.
You're listening to Security Nation with host Kyle Flaherty.
And you can just keep eating your Indian food too, as you, we do have Indian food. Josh, thanks for joining me. One of the first questions I had for you, because it's something that we actually hear about from a lot of our listeners and the folks that are out there, building a security team, like actually putting the talent together. How hard is it? What are your, you know, what do you think about when you have to do that? Does it put you in the flop sweats and just to like find all that talent?
You know, I think how you answer that really depends on the organization that you're trying to help keep safe. For Rapid7, we're lucky that we have the latitude to go out and try and explore new ways to build a good security team, to staff a good security team. But I would say, especially for listeners that are at companies that are just trying to start a security team, or they're at small companies that have said, hey, wait, this is actually pretty important, so we want to start taking it seriously. I think the two things that tend to get in our way the most are creativity and money. There's kind of this set notion of what a security team should look like, what a security engineer looks like, and I think that that notion, it has a lot of flaws in it. And so when you get a little bit more creative about thinking about the problems you face and how you can start to address them, if you're getting out in the community and you're active, the skill gap, the worker gap starts to shrink some. Not in all verticals, but in some.
But do you think that you mentioned importance, and I love the idea of the creativity part, and I want to get back to that. But do you think it's easier building it inside of an actual security company, or does it actually pose unique challenges that others might not?
I think it's easier. So it's one of the reasons I get scared answering the question. I think there's a lot of appeal for high aptitude, creative people with a great attitude to want to come in and understand that not only are we doing cool things to help keep us safe, we also get to touch a lot of other areas in product and sales and marketing.
Right.
And there's a ton of different career paths that people can take from the security team into the organization. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly an appeal. And most of the people that we're interested in from a technical perspective have played with Metasploit, so
true.
It makes it easier for us, I think.
But all right, so let's flip it a little bit. If I don't work at a security company, and I gotta prove the importance of it, because I want to be creative and I want the budget and all that kind of stuff that goes with it, how do I do that?
Yeah, you know, the first most important thing that I try and talk to people about when they're building a security team is that if your notion of a security team is going and spending a lot of capital dollars to get tools like IPS and install them, and now you're secure, you're gonna have a problem because it's not interesting work. And so, if you have the political capital or the personal wherewithal to fight through kind of the perception of what a security team is supposed to be, and you start with the premise that instead of just identifying problems for people and throwing them over a wall, that you actually want to be the tool that helps solve those problems, then you're going to be going out and you're going to be looking for people who need to be able to build cool solutions, mm-hmm. not just implement tools that you purchase. And I think that in most places you can find, they might be, like, you're going to have to go for fewer years of experience than you'd like, but you're going to be able to find those high-apt people that are in dead-end jobs or jobs that aren't interesting, and if you take a little bit of a risk on them, if you've got a good spidey sense on people, mm-hmm. It can have a really positive outcome.
And so when you're actually doing that hiring and you're looking for that creative person or whatnot, what are the things that kind of you look for?
Yeah, there's three or four things that come to mind immediately. I'd say that, you know, I used spidey sense a little bit earlier, right? Like, It's
do you literally have spidey sense?
I wish. This breaking news? I was bitten by a spider once.
Just blew your hand up.
I don't know.
Got horribly infected, but I don't think I have special powers.
So we'll use spider sense in the metaphorical sense. I would say curiosity, aptitude, and attitude are the three main drivers of every person that we bring into the security team at Rapid7. And there really is no substitute. There is, like, if you have somebody that doesn't have a great attitude, they're going to be poisonous to your team. People outside of your team are not going to want to work with them. So you're going to hear about less and less. People are going to involve you more infrequently. And it's just going to create a ton of problems. If you hire somebody who isn't curious, they're really going to be relying on just one person to tell them exactly what they need to do, opposed to empowering them to go out, see a potential issue, experiment, try and fix it. Mm-hmm. And if you hire somebody that doesn't have a really high aptitude, you're going to run into something where maybe they have an idea, but they're not going to be the person that's going to jump on Google and start to research how to solve it. They're going to look for somebody else to tell them how to solve it.
Do you think all of those are equally weighted, or do you actually look and weight them a little bit differently depending on your need?
I don't know that I weight them differently. Okay. I think that there are just things that need to exist in each candidate.
Okay.
So I would never say, okay, you're not curious, but you're really smart and have a great attitude. I mean, again, this is when I was talking about organizations being different. You might be able to give some sort of weighting by role if you have a 150-person security team. When you've got a 15- or 20-person security team, you really need a bunch of A players that bring all of those things together to operate with efficiency.
So you mentioned a little bit ago some of the unique aspects of actually building a security team within a security company. One of those is giving feedback to the product teams overall. And as we've moved into, you know, you mentioned Metasploit, obviously there's other products, but we're moving into more and more of a SaaS-based world from a security tools perspective as well. And so you've dealt with it from, you know, just the risk inside of the organization of people out and using those tools to us actually pushing out these type of tools as well. And so I know that the product team is constantly kind of picking your brain about that, but what's happened for you over the years as this has moved on?
Yeah, this has been one of the more substantive shifts in my view of risk in an organization.
Right.
And I think there's a few different viewpoints that you can take. The first is, for respected infrastructure or software as a service vendors like AWS or Salesforce, insert big name company here, these are some of the most tested and attacked targets in the world. Mm. So, you know, the question is, do we think we can protect our internally run and maintain CRM better than Salesforce protects their environment? They've got a huge amount of resources to throw at trying to keep that safe. And so I think that there is an established track record now of success, especially in the larger companies. Mm-hmm. There is a huge benefit in decentralization for us or for any company in that no longer in a decentralized environment, if architected well, does a compromised domain admin credential mean that you immediately lose all of your data.
Right.
If somebody is able to compromise a domain admin credential, bypass two-factor authentication, and do a bunch of other things, which certainly isn't impossible, which is much harder to do than it used to be, they're not going to be able to dump all of our customer data, emails, phone records, and a lot of the other types of things that we've seen in some of the scarier breaches that have happened over the past several years.
Yeah.
So both a little bit of a track record, decentralization, letting people that are focusing on protecting the crown jewels of their business do that, so you're not trying to do it, and also understanding that now maybe a system's compromised or a user's compromised, but if you detect it with any degree of speed, it's going to be much harder to have all of your company's data exfiltrated.
Yeah, and I think the other thing too is, and this is something that I know you've spoken to me about, and as teams, as we roll out these products, the transparency of how this all works, where we are, where the data is, how, you know, and you look at the trust pages for whether it's Rapid7 or others, and we've looked at others as inspiration for that. I think that's a huge part of this as well.
Yeah, there's no question. There's a couple of companies out there whose names I won't say that were historically looked at really poorly, and may in many cases still are looked at poorly on how they handle what they do with their customer data is probably a better way to put it, and how they monetize it. But if there's one thing these companies have done extraordinarily well, it's come out and say, this is what we're using your data for, this is how we're using it, this is how you can get visibility into it. And so while it's not perfect, transparency is certainly a key component to building trust with your customer base. Mm-hmm. And so when you can sit down with anybody in an organization, talk to them about the security program, talk to them about how they manage this data and the privacy around it, and they're being honest and forthright with you, to me that's often that certainly gains a little bit of points in the score column. So even if their security program isn't perfect, the fact that they're being upfront with it shows me a level of organizational maturity that I'm more comfortable working with.
Yeah, and I think too part of it is, and I'm not just saying this because it's something that we do, but you have to put the same type of go-to-market, if you will, philosophy and strategy to the data and the security of the data and all of those things as you would to any product you're trying to sell or any of that stuff. And I think for a long time, we didn't really think of it that way. The marketing organization wasn't necessarily talking to the product organization and certainly wasn't talking to the security organization about a trust page with a white paper and a solutions brief and those types of things because it didn't seem like it was the traditional go-to-market type of stuff. But I think now you got to have that.
What's been really interesting to watch, actually, I agree that you should have it.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you have to have it is really organizationally dependent. But which
organization, the one that you're in or the customer,
the SaaS provider.
There
are a lot of services that are provided where the customer just doesn't care, for better or for worse.
Right.
The customer doesn't care.
May not even know.
Right.
Right.
And so for us, we were always, at least we've always strived to be as transparent as we can about what we do well, what we don't. The biggest issue is that as our company has scaled and grown at the rate it has, our ability to respond transparently to every request became less and less practical.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, the trust page was not really asked for, but it's something that allows us to go out and get ahead of a lot of the questions that people were coming in and asking of us.
Right. Success and measurement of success for security teams. This is a question I had a series of CISO interviews in Minneapolis a few months ago, and it was very interesting to hear from all these folks. So I'll ask the same question of you: of how do you measure success? What does it look like? And then how do you report that up?
Yeah, it is.
Or even, I shouldn't even just say up, quite frankly, across, right?
It's a really fascinating question. It's one that we still struggle with here.
Were the other questions not as fascinating?
No, this one's the most fascinating so far.
Okay, fair enough. Good.
So for our team, we measure things that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Right. A lot of times there's pressure on CISOs or security organizations. They show me the metrics, give me a scorecard.
Yeah.
And what ends up happening is they have an immature program, and then they're trying to make up numbers that demonstrate how their program's performing.
Right.
And so I'd say you don't want to create numbers that don't really solve any problems or inform anybody about something that means something to them,
mm-hmm.
for the sake of having them.
Right.
What you want to do is you really want to understand what your goals are, put processes in place to support those goals, and then measure both how you're doing in delivering against those goals and how those processes are performing well or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our core focus. It's another thing that's organizationally dependent. I think the thing that's not organizationally dependent is don't feel pressured to provide numbers for the sake of providing numbers and metrics. Understand if you've got a compliance issue that you need to measure, or a large deployment, or a security feature that you need to measure, and figure out how you can start to track those measurements, how you can start tracking those rollouts, those projects, those goals in a way that actually shows people, hey, we're making progress, and potentially also demonstrates when there's risk because there's either a substantive change that should be scary, or there's not enough change.
Right.
So if you focus on those specific examples and you target the constituents that you're presenting the data to in a way that's relevant to them, the numbers will actually mean something. But you don't want to say this is how many malware infections we've responded to.
Right. And I think the other part is, and I think it's layered into what you're talking about, is the visibility of the security team across the organization. And that's something that at least I hadn't experienced as much as I do here. And again, maybe it's, although I've only worked for security companies, but your team in a lot of cases is a service to the employees. And so we see that a lot, whether it's just tips and tricks or like whatever it is. And I mean, is that something you do on purpose or is it just natural to the people that you're hiring?
So a family member of mine got me really set on the track, and I know we'll talk about this later. Got me set on the career track that I'm on now, probably in the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to him back when there was like six CISOs in the world, but I remember he said very clearly, he's like, the only good CISOs I know and respect are the ones that can turn a security function into into something that helps the bottom line, not hurts the bottom line.
Right.
And so when I talk about attitude, aptitude, culture fit, curiosity, the goal is building a service-oriented organization that wants to go out and have a positive impact on the business. We want to make things easier. We want to help make our products better. And that's really the underlying culture of the team.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier to do something like that at a company like Rapid7 than it may be at a paper company.
Right.
Doesn't mean that you can't. If you bring in the right people, you're going to be really good at automating things and making things simpler. So if you're starting every rollout, everything that you do with the premise of trying to understand how that's going to impact the business and how to minimize that impact, you're going to build a good reputation for your team.
Yeah, and you talked about again the products. And one thing I wanted to talk about was, and the contributing to the bottom line. I mean, this hits it directly. Eating our own dog food, if you will, or it's probably a better terminology for that. I'd like to think of one.
Drinking your own champagne.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. That's classy. Yeah. You're really classing up the podcast today. I like that. Must be the Indian food that we have sitting in front of us. But, you know, how does that help the organization overall? Like, where do you see, as you guys use our own products for obvious security, you know, just like our own customers do, how do you feed that back kind of into the cycle?
Yeah, we've worked on figuring out how to get better and better at that. And it's a mix of ways. It can be informal email feedback. For some of our products, we have a biweekly sit down where we actually anecdotally go through situations we've encountered, what worked well, what didn't. We're definitely trying to figure out the right way to formalize it.
Mm-hmm.
A large portion of our security team sits in our Cambridge Development Center over here, which is where a couple of our specific products are developed. And so we've definitely seen a much more direct impact there than we have as we've tried to scale out to some of the more remote teams. And mm-hmm. that's definitely a big focus of ours over the next 12 to 18 months to make sure we're not just helping one product, that we can expand that impact.
Right, exactly. You hinted at another fascinating question. But your career and the path. So you talked about getting some guidance about what a great CISO is, but kind of take people through how you got into this role.
Yes. You know, it's funny because I always feel like I say this when I'm talking to people. I'm really lucky in that what I do today is the same stuff my parents were yelling at me when I was 9 years old to stop doing.
Right.
Because I was up too late on the computer doing things that I shouldn't admit to on a podcast. And so over time, I've always had a relationship with the technology community, with the security community. I've always poked and prodded and tried to figure out how things work, why they work. And as I was working my way towards college, I started to get advice, don't go to college. Nobody in our industry goes to college. And I ignored that advice. And during college, I met as one of my professors actually started the Maryland State Police Computer Crime Unit. And I started to help him out at that unit. And, you know, I was going through a very significant set of personal situations where I was trying to decide, do I go into first being a first responder? Do I go into law enforcement? Do I go into private industry? And I ultimately, through a series of events, had that decision forced on me and ended up pretty quickly at Deloitte in their federal security and privacy practice. And once I landed there and I got to operate in some of the organizations and entities that I did, it really accelerated in many ways my need to become more comfortable with the business and large businesses and processes and less focused on technology.
Mm.
And I just kind of kept going, and I'd say over the last 8 or so years, my shtick has really been going to hypergrowth technology companies and helping them start their security teams.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know really how I fell into that other than, you know, I was in consulting, and it was fun. I learned a lot. I didn't like going and telling people, here are all of your problems, go fix it.
Right.
Right. I liked being able to sit down and try and, like I said, be creative, figure out how to build something that's going to impact the business, and then to watch that grow and watch people become more successful around it and learn and things continue to mature and get better. And that's just fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's really how I ended up, how I ended up at Rapid7 through a series of just kind of random conversations I had with people several years ago.
If you were going to, you know, stand in front of yourself back then, knowing what you know now, or even just someone who, you know, is in the same position that you were, much like your professor and your other mentors kind of gave you, what's the big piece of advice that you tell people now?
Yeah, I think the most important thing that I try and tell, especially younger practitioners, is that the job of a security practitioner isn't to keep a company safe.
Mm.
It's to identify the risk that exists in a business, to advocate for resources to fix that risk, and then to effectively use the resources you're given. Because as soon as you start trying to look through the lens of a practitioner who sees all of the things that are wrong, and then they understand how quickly their business is growing and that they don't even really see 20% of it, you quickly go down a rabbit hole where you just think everybody's terrible and you need to put these roadblocks in place and things need to slow down. And what I think you frequently find is that practitioners that don't reorient themselves around what their actual role is in a business, they end up in a situation where they slow down businesses and they tend to cause more harm than the risk that they're trying to prevent would actually cause.
I like that. Last and most important question. When we do the next podcast and I have you here, what are we going to get for lunch?
We can start the tradition and we could do Indian.
Every time?
I mean, it could be a tradition.
It could be a tradition. I love traditions.
I'd have to think about that.
Right.
You know, it's really mood dependent.
Well,
podcasts
I think,
are serious
you know what,
business.
Forget it. We're going to put it out to the community. And if they've made it this far in the podcast,
They
just got a hashtag pod lunch and tell us what we should get next time when we record this.
Okay.
Pod lunch. Hashtag pod lunch. Makes sense, right?
I'm a little terrified by that.
It's better than post-it password. That was our last hashtag, and people told us what color post-it that they put their password on their desk. So that was fun as well. We just like to see if people actually, you know, make it all the way to the end of the pod.
If you could actually just use that same hashtag and take a picture of the post-it, right. we'd really appreciate it.
Just send it to us. I like that. Awesome. Well, excellent. Another Security Nation in the books. Thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Thanks.